Okay, well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Old Stone House. Welcome to this month's edition of Musical Ecologies. This is a monthly series, or symposium, as we like to call it, here at the Old Stone House. Always on a Thursday, usually the second Thursday of the month. Sometimes another Thursday, but always a Thursday and always every month, except for July and August. And we always begin our evenings here with a conversation, and tonight our guest is Mary Jane Leach. Welcome, Mary Jane.
Thank you.
And I'm your host, Dan Joseph, and I have a few schedules here. We have a couple more concerts remaining in the program, or in the season, so invite you to take one of these home. Next month we have violinist Shem Gaburi here. We'll be giving a recital of a collection of contemporary composers. And June is our final day. We're still working on that program. But back to tonight. So welcome again, Mary Jane.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So Mary Jane is, as many of you know, a longtime veteran here of the New York new music scene. I guess going back, at least 30 years? here? Oh, this is a good thing, huh?
Yes.
But recently, or relatively recently, at least in the span of the 30-year range, you've recently left the city for the Hudson Valley, where you're living. For how many years has it been?
About 10 years.
10 years? Okay. I didn't know it was that long.
I live in an old 10,000 square foot church.
One moment. Great, thank you. So you're living in a church in Valley Falls,
yeah.
And how did that come about? I mean, I just out of curiosity, really.
Well, I used to live near Columbia University, and I was in my favorite place, the Hungarian pastry shop, which most of you probably know.
Sure.
And I was reading the Columbia Spectator, and there was this ad for this house in that general area. I was going, oh, that's pretty reasonable. And I looked at the map, I thought, wow, it's not in the middle of nowhere, it was convenient to a lot of places. And
right. That's
one of the things that intrigued me about it was because, it was near Albany, it was near Troy, it was near Bennington, it was near North Adams,
right.
North Saratoga. So it wasn't like living in not New York City,
right.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like moving to the Catskills is kind of like not New York City as opposed to whatever. And
right.
So I just drove up, and the first day I started looking, I saw this listing for a church. It's going, if it's it at all decent, I want it.
Right.
And I walked in and, tested the acoustics and, we actually were the real estate agent, and I turned around the corner and we're going oh my God. Because everybody says, I live in a big church, and as Dan can attest, it really is big. It's bigger than you think it's gonna be, isn't it?
It's a truly big church.
Yes.
Right, so you have living space and, I guess, workspace
concert space.
So you're doing some concerts there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. Well, as I've learned, you're also, you're continuing to do music, of course, but you're also you're doing a lot of writing as well as a music journalist. Is that that's a new thing for you?
Music and theater critic.
Yes. So that just sort of evolved naturally, or how did that come about?
It came about because Jody Dalton, who used to run CRI,
sure.
he reviews for the Albany Times Union up there, and they needed somebody to cover something, he couldn't do it, so they asked me to do it, and ever since then I've been getting more and more work, and then just like in the past year, I've been reviewing theater too, because I actually have a pretty solid theater background.
Right.
And so that's been fun. And actually, it's amazing how much good theater there is up there, both community, and then I reviewed at the Barrington Stage, which is in Pittsfield, which is a professional theater. So it's been fun, again, honing my writing chops. And it's really amazing to do something and have to file a few hours later.
Right.
Really less than 12 hours later, so it's
a lot of time to think about it.
Yeah. I'm used to, I'll sleep on this, It's like the way I write music, too.
Right.
I do my best writing in my dreams.
Right.
Seriously. I know I'm on a really good track if I start dreaming about a piece.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I think a lot of us can share that, or at least some version of that experience of, you know, composing just in your day-to-day life, not necessarily, you know, actually putting the notes down. That's more of a kind of a routine.
Yeah, it's more like the concept.
Yeah, it's just like the final touches, really, right? I think I share that, and I'm sure a lot of people do. I mean, it's a way of reminding yourself that, you know, you're always at work, especially as you get more involved in a piece.
Yeah, and it keeps it more organic in a way, too.
Sure. So what have you been working on lately? I mean, I know we'll talk a little bit in a moment about what we're going to hear tonight, but beyond that, I mean, what are some of the compositional projects you have going or that are developing for you?
Well,
right now?
One thing I really want to do is I want to do sort of like a small chamber opera based on Jean Genet's The Maids.
Uh-huh. Nice.
And I came up with this great concept a couple months ago, and that is, because I don't, do you know the story at all?
I don't.
Do you know The Maids at all? It's a play for three female characters, or it can be three male characters. And Genet originally wrote it for three male characters, but it's usually done with three female characters. And it's about these kind of like sadomasochistic sisters who are, it's based on a real life story, who work for this woman, and they continually plot how to kill her and how to demean each other and everything. It's pretty interesting. Anyway, I had this idea to do like a double cast so that you'd have like a male cast and a female cast and kind of do mirror images, and then you could like, instead of just having everything in sort of one register, like all female voices or all male voices, then you could sort of have like dialogues between, you know, the male and female characters.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I actually think it would be a pretty cool thing to do. And this summer they're doing a production of The Maids at Lincoln Center.
Really?
So maybe there's like a little buzz about it.
So how did your idea emerge? I mean, was there...
I've always been a Genet fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I first lived here, like maybe, I don't know, I think like 1978 or 79, I was really into him. I read every single thing by him and took copious notes, and I always had in mind that I wanted to do something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was thinking more like of a play,
right.
You know, like taking Our Lady of the Flowers and sort of having like a sort of ensemble piece based around that, but it was mostly a play. But for a number of years now, I've been thinking about The Maids, and this idea of the double cast just kind of made me go, yes, that's it.
Wow, sounds great.
Yeah.
Sounds great. Have you written an opera or chamber opera or some kind of text sort of program music kind of a piece? Or
The time.
Okay.
Yeah, usually in foreign languages and sometimes several languages at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I have all these pieces like, you know, where there's like simultaneous like Greek and Italian and Greek, Italian, Latin. And ancient Cretan sometimes, and worked with like, you know, old French and things like that. So yeah, I'm pretty used to setting text.
Right. Well, good. Well, that sounds wonderful.
And I'm a singer, you know.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, I was thinking more in terms of an actual opera kind of.
I've never done anything where there's like actual staging and stuff,
but
having been starting to review so much theater lately, it sort of got the old juices flowing again. It's
right. I remember reading one of your reviews of the, was it John Harbison?
That was
really
cool.
Quite inspired by that.
Yeah.
Positive review. It made me want to hear the piece.
Sure.
What was that piece again? I mean,
his opera based on the Great Gatsby.
Gatsby, that's what I thought. Okay.
And it was like one of those things that like all the other critics hated,
right.
But they didn't get it, because I think sometimes you have to be a composer, and one of the things I noted was like kind of the overall shape and how like as the piece progressed the styles kind of like crossfaded, so that, you know, there was like the pop music and then it sort of became more atonal, and there was just the shape of the whole thing was really interesting. You know, to be frank, you know, like the New York Times critic totally missed the point, you know. And sometimes they do because they have agendas, you know.
Sure.
Duh. But, you know, and I have to say, I mean, I'm not like a Harbison fan or, you know, or an apologist or anything like
right.
that.
It just,
but
it just worked for you. It really
it did. Yeah. It
wow.
did.
And your review really communicated that. Yeah.
You know, and he's like a really effective orchestrator. You know, there's he's a very good composer. And it worked better because it was sort of a semi-staged show and not like, you know, a big Met production.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Well, I hope that I hope.
And the other thing that has inspired me, speaking of staging, is how many of you, did any of you see The Nose at the Met?
Yes. No, the HD, the film.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? With William Kentridge's staging just blew my mind.
Totally.
Just was so inspiring.
Very much so.
He's just, it turns out he's a famous he's a famous artist, and when they did the show the Met at the Met, there was a one man show at MoMA too.
Right.
You know, and I'd never heard of him. I went to the HD thinking, oh, I want to hear some Shostakovich, and then I came out going, William Kentridge, and you know, I can't wait to see what he's going to do with Lulu in a couple of years.
Uh-huh.
He's doing a production of Lulu in
for the Met
15.
As well.
Yeah.
Correct.
The orchestra wasn't loud enough in the HD. Did you notice that?
I was so entranced by the visuals there.
I think that's the thing with the HDs, is to tamp down the orchestra and make the vocals more prominent.
It's also interesting with the HD because you can see what happens backstage.
These are live broadcast in film theaters, or these are produced afterwards? I know that the Met is broadcasting their live concerts.
It's usually done live, and then they do subsequent showings of it from that original taping.
But in a movie theater, basically, or even in BAM sometimes.
Yeah, all over the country.
So that's what that was how you guys experienced the.
Yeah, yeah, and it's fantastic because he also worked vertically, which was really interesting because he took like a one man show, basically. I mean, there was only one real character, and just filled the entire Met stage, and it was like inspiring. It was really inspiring.
So it sounds like you're kind of on an opera thing now.
Yeah.
Well, I really hope that your piece comes together. I mean, I guess, is it something you would just compose in earnest, or is there the seeds of some kind of a collaboration or production with a group or a presenter or?
Well, I mean, I put a couple of grants out, so we'll see what happens. But then an old friend of mine, who was actually one of my apprentices in Shakespeare Festival, when I worked at Shakespeare Festival, is the head of the theater department in Worcester. And he sent me an email because I told him about doing The Maids. He goes, I think that's a great project. He says, I'd really like to direct it if you can, and we can take it to Edinburgh. And, you know, he's already fantasizing about what we can do with it. So, you know, if worse comes to worse, you know, I don't get big grant, can work with him perhaps. Yeah.
Great. Well, there's certainly, as I'm sure many of us have noticed, I mean, there's a huge opera renaissance in a sense, or maybe even a new model for opera in New York City, if not everywhere. I don't know the scope of it, but certainly in New York, we're seeing a lot of new sort of modest scale opera ventures, you know, the Prototype Festival, for example.
And yeah, but you know, there aren't many of us who actually know how to write for voice and have a theater background.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that I think there's really a groundswell, and I think that there are new organizations, dedicated to this kind of work. So I think now is a great time to be developing a piece like this.
So
I really wish you luck with that.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Pardon?
Why? Well, I don't know. That maybe that's another evening here on Musical Retro.
Maybe because it seems less abstract in a way.
Well, I think people are. I mean,
words,
costumes, sets.
But you know, I'm actually a firm believer in like, it's the sound that conveys it. It's not necessarily the words and the meaning that. But you can. I mean, I went to see the Comédie Française a few times in Montreal because they used to show there. You didn't have to know a word of French to get what was going on.
Right.
You know, if it's like successful theater.
Yeah, well, it seems to me, I mean, to try to answer that question. I mean, just maybe it's obvious. It just seems to me with the way that our culture has moved so much more into a kind of multimedia, you know, kind of mode where, you know, with all of the movies and TVs, and I mean, just do music alone is not sufficient for a lot of people now. You know, so naturally people are putting together these full productions of stories and sets.
But
and
then you also
action.
Have to deal with the ADHD.
Yeah,
I guess. You know, it's like, I mean, I've worked with students. If you play anything more than 3 minutes, you know, they're going like, God, do I have to listen to this long piece? You know, it's like,
right. Well, I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but it's clearly going on.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
We'll see what happens. Yeah.
Well, good. Well, that's great. Well, okay. Well, okay. But more to the tonight's program a little
yeah.
bit. So the music that I know you by the most, and perhaps many of us do, are these works for multiple instruments. So I wanted to talk about a little bit about that. I mean, it's still, you know, listening to them, some of the earlier works that you composed, I guess most of them maybe in the 80s and 90s, the ones that are on CD and with XI, and, you know, it's still a very powerful form. So how, I'm curious how you came to this. I mean, you seem to, I identify you as one of the, probably the foremost proponents of this kind of multiple flutes and multiple bassoons, and how did that come about?
Kind of by accident. I was like, there were a whole bunch of us who were playing, had a group called the Wind Band that Charlie Morrow was part of, and I was just starting to play bass clarinet, and everybody in the group played like a weird instrument, like sort of non-standard, and we were always having tuning problems. So I said, I want to make sure I'm not the one who's playing out of tune. And I said, I know that I can like sing a straight tone. So I taped myself singing a straight tone and started playing with it. And then I started realizing that if I started getting slightly out of tune, that you could create beats, things like that, and then create sort of sound phenomena. So that started the whole thing of like layering pieces. And you kind of had to like stagger all the entrances, because if everybody stopped, the sound phenomena would drop out.
Right.
So that's kind of how I had this sort of layering, sort of multi-track thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then originally, you know, like I had access to 4 tracks, and
right.
then it graduated to 8 tracks.
Right.
And then someone suggested to me one time, because I was doing everything on 8-track with the vocals, hey, you could hire 8 singers.
How about that?
So I became a choral composer. You know, because it's a lot easier to get 8 singers than like
eight
oboists,
yeah,
or,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
I have a piece for like 7 bassoons and
right.
9 oboes and on and on, 10 flutes.
Right.
So that's kind of how it started. It's just that, you know, I started out doing instruments that I could play. And then as soon as I had access to like a computer and MIDI playback, you know, sort of began to write for other instruments. And I would just do copious studies of what does it sound like when everybody's playing unison? What does it happen when I, you know, start panning things differently or add an octave? Or you'd start hearing like little sound phenomena happening, and what happens when I start like notating that da 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 happening, and seeing what would happen next. So that's kind of how it all happened.
Great. And when did that? What was roughly the beginning of that for you? I mean, just chronologically, I'm just curious.
I guess sort of like about 1980 or so.
And
I mean, the first time I heard the beating, I thought I destroyed my speakers.
All right. Well, like. I can imagine that.
Yeah.
It's like, what was that?
Yeah. Okay. But, you know, then I realized, you know, you could start playing around with it, you know, so you, when you moved around in space, you could, like, change the sort of the speed of the beating and,
right.
you know, change things.
Sure.
And the first piece that I'm going to play today isn't a multiple piece, but it is from when I lived in Cologne and lived in this tower attached to a church, and it had this organ that had 2 sets of pipes that you could control separately. And there was a really wonderful stop on it where you could play a ninth. So you'd press one note and it would play a ninth. So of course I'd want to play minor and major seconds, and so you'd get like all this kind of beating happening, and depending on the weather, you know, it could take like 8 seconds for the beating to start. It could take like 15 seconds for the beating to start. So
just in terms of the mechanics of the organ to really get to fill up the room.
Yeah,
and so on.
Depending on how dense the air was.
Right.
You know, because you'd get the, you know, sounds happening from the opposite ends of the church.
Sure, sure. The whole room becomes part of the phenomenon, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and it changed daily.
I'm
you
sure.
know, so you kind of had to just, you know, go with it, you know.
Mm-hmm. So the piece, so the title, is that that's Dowland's Tears or no?
No,
that's
it's called Pipe Dreams.
Pipe Dreams, I'm sorry, yes. So that dates to
1989.
During the years that you were living in Germany?
Yeah, yeah, and I'm at the time I made, I used to do, probably most of you haven't seen it, but I used to do a lot of visual work to go with my pieces. And when I lived in, I used to do a lot of sort of collages with slides, but when I lived in Germany, I didn't have access to a lot of stuff. You know,
mm-hmm.
I didn't have my slide projectors or anything. So I made these, I took a sort of a stylized stained glass window,
mm-hmm.
just, you know, basic triangles and stuff. And what I did was I made a projection of what it would look like sort of on, if it the light was coming through the window on, and the image, you know, the colors were on the floor.
Uh-huh.
And so then I did something totally unrealistic, which was to have the light coming from the opposite direction as well, which, you know, you'd never have in real life.
Right.
But so then I would have the overlapping parts were the primaries, which would make secondary colors.
Mm-hmm,
do you
mm-hmm.
know what those are?
Some color theory stuff.
Huh? Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So
red and
blue, green, and red are the
right.
primaries, and then, you know, red and green make yellow, and so on and so on. So anyway, I did that, and I made these tiny, tiny little cutouts, and made, you know, did it all like on this. With slides,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which practically ruined my eyesight doing it, because I made about 50 slides
so
that way.
So you actually drew or constructed the slide?
Yes, I had like sticky tape.
It wasn't a photographic.
No, I had sticky tape.
Right, okay.
Clear sticky tape, and then I you know.
With paper or some kind of, how do you create the colors in this?
Oh, with theatrical gels.
Theatrical gels,
I
okay,
spent
gotcha.
I spent one summer putting all of the, used to get theatrical gels, and they'd come in like booklets about this size, and you could get two, and they would fit into a slide frame.
Mm-hmm.
So one summer, I put all of the commercially available gels into chronological order. Which isn't totally, you can't do it totally, because it's like a parabola, and then there's the magenta line. And it's like the same with sound, you know, like the louder, you know, like color saturation and dynamics,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you combine two frequencies and you get another frequency. So there's a lot of similarities.
Oh, absolutely.
And I worked, one of the first jobs I did in New York was I did lighting off Broadway,
mm-hmm.
and I worked with this incredible lighting designer named Arden Fingerhut. And we used to have these long discussions about how lighting and music were very similar.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so she inspired me a lot too.
Excellent. So we're gonna hear Pipe Dreams, a
yep.
recording of Pipe Dreams with these visuals that you're describing.
Well, these aren't the exact visuals. At a certain point, I got really tired of showing up to gigs and people saying, "Oh, you really wanted two slide projectors and a dissolve unit?" So I, you know, and also it became kind of antiquated at a certain
right.
point.
Right.
So a couple years ago, I made sort of
an
animation, yeah,
right.
an animated version of it on my computer.
I see.
Yeah.
So, but
the concept
it
is still kind
similar.
Of there.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
So that's so we're gonna see that come to life in Pipe Dreams, right?
Yeah.
Excellent. So that's one piece tonight. Now there is a piece also on the program tonight, also with visuals, which is a multiple piece, right?
Yes, it's for 8 women's voices. And it's based kind of loosely using some pitch material and syllables from Monteverdi, Lamento d'Arianna.
Mm-hmm.
And the recording that we made isn't like totally, it was meant to be like quadraphonic, but of
right.
course it's not quadraphonic. So, but there are all these like clockwise and counterclockwise and diagonal patterns going on.
Right, visual patterns.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I made slides to sort of mirror structurally what is happening in that, and so that there's all this kind of colors that are overlapping, creating other colors, and then you'll see that there's, it's sort of like a labyrinth that's happening.
Right. So we want to imagine. So this is a four-part vocal work, right?
Eight-part.
Okay. And so we're to imagine if we were hearing it in a kind of a surround or a quadraphonic or octophonic version, and then the visuals that we'll be seeing will more or less correspond what's going
not
on in the vocal
one-to-one,
writing.
But the general idea is there.
Right. So that's really bringing this correspondence between sound and visuals to, you know, to a real kind of synchronized degree.
Yeah. And the last piece in the concert is a more recent piece, because the Mountain Echoes, which is the second piece, is from 87. And this other, the final piece is Dallin's Tears, which is for 10 flutes. And I wrote it a couple of years ago for this incredible flute player from Rome. Mm-hmm. And he had this whole project based around John Dallin and the Lacrimae. And Dallin was always a big inspiration to me, because when I worked in Shakespeare Festival in the summers, we always had like Dallin records and we'd play it for incidental music and everything. And I always really loved his music. Mm-hmm. So he said something and I said, yes, I'd love to do that.
Perfect,
so I wrote this piece for him and I sent it off and I didn't hear from him for a couple of days. And I'm going like, oh God, he hates it. And like 2 days later, he says, I've already recorded it, and I made this video to go with it, and I've got three performances lined up next month. And it's like, oh, okay. But even better was that he got it, you know, because a lot of times, you know, you have to tell people like what to do with the, you know, how to play the piece. And when you have, especially with like these kind of pieces that can be very static.
Right.
If you kind of mush the entrances, it just becomes mush, and it doesn't have any kind of rhythmic propulsion at all, and it's much harder for the performers too.
Mm-hmm.
So when he did that, I created a solo part for him so that he would have something to play in concert.
Right. And so we're here, and the flutist is Manuel Zuria.
Manuel Zuria,
and we're hearing his recording, I guess, of his playing all the parts. And
he's worked with Phil Korner a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Put that in context.
Right. Well, great. Well, so that's our evening lineup here. I mean, I guess that's, you know, a little upwards 45 minutes or an hour or something like that.
No, more like 45 minutes.
Mm. Well, great. So. All right, so we're almost ready to do that. I did have one other thing I wanted to bring up with you that I'm curious about. It. You know, when else are we going to have the chance to sit here and talk? And that is, I wanted to find out a little bit more about this project that I've heard through others that you're involved with, which is a book, I believe, about the composer Julius Eastman. I want to find out a little bit more about
that. Oh, yeah, I thought we'd get through a whole night without talking about him.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. I was just curious because, you know, it's just a name that I've been, you know, I'm a little bit familiar with his work, but I just thought, you know, I wondered what was going on with that. Or
okay.
So you've written a book about his work, or
no? It's in the works. Does everybody know who Julius was? Yeah. Well, about I think it was, I was getting ready to teach a course at Cal Arts, and they said, everybody there was kind of a computer person, and so they said, we want you to teach real instruments.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, wow, teach real instruments, you know, like, I thought the idea of multiples, you know, so that, you know, you really get the essence of each instrument, you know, like 10 cellos and 8 bassoons, whatever. And so I wanted to do this piece by Julius.
Right.
And Lois Vierk had a cassette. She went to give me a copy, and the cassette box was empty. So then she directed me to Brian Rulon, and he made a dub for me, and he sort of...
Of a Julius Eastman piece.
Yes, he sort of informed me that Julius's music had basically disappeared.
I see.
You know, because he, you know, he...
Well,
gone off the rails, and his music was like thrown on the street, and you know, his music had just disappeared. So when I came back from CalArts, I thought, well, you know, I'll try to see if I can find the score, and you know, I hate to waste this energy that I put into this already. And thinking it would be fairly easy because I found the masters for the cello piece pretty easily.
The recordings.
Yes, because Steve Kellum had made the recording.
I see.
But it turned out to not be that easy, and it took a long time. And finally, about, I don't know, 8 years later, a 3-CD set came out on New World, and it's become one of their best sellers.
Really? Interesting.
And his music is being performed all over the world. So Renee Levine Packer, who used to run the Creative Associates at SUNY Buffalo, she had written a book about them, and then she knew Julius very well. So she and I are collaborating on a book, and she's kind of doing the biographical part, and I'm putting together the musical part. So,
I see. So it's an ongoing project.
Yeah. Yeah, we've learned a lot of lessons, like, you know, like, don't work with musicologists, you know. Because, you know, they, you know, it's a long story. I don't want to get into it.
I gather there are rules.
It's kind of a cutthroat thing, and most of them aren't that interested in the music. They just want to get published, you know. So, moral of the story is working with more people who actually love the music and aren't so interested in, you know, all this other stuff.
Right. And so this, so does this have any kind of, I mean, I don't, yeah, does it have any estimated time of publication or anything like that, or is it how?
Well, once we eliminated the musicologist who had been holding us up for a couple of years,
things are flowing.
yeah, actually, it's you know, so it's looking more hopeful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, good. Well, it's just something that I've been hearing about recently. I just wanted to check in on that and find out what's going on with that.
Funny you should ask.
So I gather you hear a lot about this thing. Is that?
Yeah.
I see. Man, I didn't realize. Well.
Yeah.
All right. Well.
Yeah. Well, it was really interesting because, just to digress just very slightly, there was a symposium on Arthur Russell a couple years ago. And you could tell, like, there are people who really loved the music and who wrote about it and talked about it. And then there are people who were just going, like, oh, yeah, Arthur Russell. And they'd write this little paper. They had no understanding of him or no sort of idea of the whole scene or anything like that. So that's what you're kind of dealing with. You're kind of dealing with, you know, people who love the music and are talking about it because they love it. And then there are other people who was like, maybe it's the hot topic and, you know, they can get public. I don't know. It's
I think I understand that. It's just kind of more opportunistic, more self-interested than they are in interested in Arthur or Julius or music.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I guess that speaks to a little bit about the, from what I gather, the culture of academia today.
Yeah.
It's very competitive. Well, great. Well, we look forward to following that story and the other stories, the, you know, your opera idea and everything else. And thank you for being here. And so I guess we'll
shall we move our chairs away and like dim the lights?
Yes. Yeah. So just give us a couple minutes here and we'll get right to it. Thank you.